From the Brennan Center for Justice, I'm Victoria Bassetti, and this is The Line. Electing presidents, it's not as easy as you might think. Something this year's election really brought home. The person who won 2.5 million more votes than her opponent has been spending most of her time post-election on hiking trips with her dog. The loser of the popular vote is planning his inauguration and selecting his cabinet. Why? Well, it's about the Electoral College. Listen closely to the odd way reporters announce the winner of presidential elections. There's not a word about how the people voted.
With the 26 electoral votes in Illinois, Richard Nixon goes over the top with 287 electoral votes. He needed 270 to win, and that seems to be the 1968 election.
I think Barbara has an important announcement.
Yes, I do. In the state of Hawaii, with 4 electoral votes, those votes have gone to Carter, and that does it. ABC now projects Carter is the winner with 272 electoral votes. By our projection, James Earl Carter, the next president of the United States.
George W. Bush of the state of Texas has received for president of the United States 271 votes. Al Gore of the state of Tennessee has received 266 votes. This announcement of the state of the vote by the President of the Senate shall be deemed a sufficient declaration of the persons elected President and Vice President of the United States. May God bless our new President and our new Vice President, and may God bless the United States of America.
So I'm here with Rick Hertzberg, who is a staff writer at The New Yorker and editorial director at The Nation Institute. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Victoria.
That last clip that we heard was Al Gore, who won the 2000 election by more than 500,000 votes. And he's announcing that George W. Bush is going to be president of the United States because of the Electoral College. That 2000 election was the fourth time in American history that the person who won the popular vote didn't become president because of the functioning of the Electoral College. And it happened again this year. So here's the big question. Is the Electoral College a fundamental part of our Constitution from the beginning, nevertheless fundamentally undemocratic?
Well, certainly it is as it has operated for most of American history. It's gotten lucky most of the time in that the popular vote has coincided with the electoral vote. But the error rate is really pretty bad now. It's about 1 in 10, I think. It wasn't designed to be either democratic or undemocratic. It was designed to be a down-and-dirty compromise between the little teeny states, especially Rhode Island, and the slave states on one side, and the other states, the bigger states, on the other side. It really isn't a beautiful creation that sprang from the forehead of the founding fathers.
So maybe we should take a quick step back and explain exactly what the Electoral College is.
Of course, the word Electoral College doesn't appear in the Constitution. Each state gets a number of electors equal to its congressional delegation, that's the total number of its members of Congress and senators. And all the Constitution really says is that the states shall appoint, not elect, a number of electors according to the way the legislature of that state shall direct. That's it in the Constitution.
So we weren't actually voting for president, were we?
Right. We were voting for a slate of electors chosen by the campaign of a presidential candidate. But it's the electors who cast the votes that elect the president.
Yeah, and they're going to meet in December. They're going to all...
They meet in their respective state capitals, and then they send their votes to Washington, and then poor Al Gore had to open them and confirm what they said.
So you are a self-described electoral college obsessive.
Mm-hmm. And
you don't like it that much, do you?
What I really don't like is not so much the electoral college. It's the state-by-state winner-take-all rule. It distorts and perverts democracy and participation because the general election only happens in about a dozen states at most. And the other roughly 40 states are just spectators. It's really outrageous when you examine the effect that this has. Presidential candidates just don't go, just don't make campaign visits to the vast majority of the country during the general election campaign. money is raised all over the country, but it only gets spent in the so-called battleground states, sometimes $0 for maybe 15 or 20 states. $0 are spent on TV ads in a majority of states. In a state like Texas, where $60 million roughly was raised in the last election, about $2,000 was spent. It also has the effect of deadening grassroots politics in the majority of the country. If you live in New York or Texas or Mississippi or California, it makes no sense to have a coffee clutch and invite your neighbors in and try to persuade them to vote for your candidate because everybody knows who's getting 100% of your state's electoral votes. So voting in those spectator states becomes more of a sort of a ritual, you know, kind of a pinch of incense on the altar of democracy. It's not really a way to participate in choosing the president. And that is what's so outrageous. To me, that's even more outrageous than the so-called wrong winner problem. Because the truth is, we don't actually know who would win, who would have won the 2000 election or this election, because the campaign would have been done in such a completely different way. And Trump himself has recently said, oh, if it had been a national election, I would have campaigned in California and Texas, and I would have won, even bigger than I won.
Yeah. And
he might be right.
There's no telling. And you know, like I hear, I'm sure you hear all the time from friends who live in the non-swing states that their vote doesn't matter. They feel kind of disengaged in the whole presidential election precisely because of that.
Yeah, it's frustrating because everyone cares. Everyone cares. And the surprising thing is that so many people do vote in these non-battleground spectator states. I mean, that shows a real hunger for wanting to be part of this, even if it's only a kind of symbolic gesture, as voting is in a non-battleground state.
So one of the things that the current election has raised and the impact of the Electoral College has raised is a lot of people have been writing and saying that the Electoral College is racist or that it has extreme racial implications.
Well, I don't think the Electoral College is racist per se right now, but it was certainly conceived in sin. One of the main reasons, maybe the main reason, for having this kind of indirect election, that is rooted in sin. Because it imports the three-fifths compromise into the selection of the president. Slaves counted as three-fifths of people just to increase the political power of the slave drivers. I mean, it doesn't get much lower than that.
But I read something that it's still to this day, because of the emphasis on swing states and that the swing states have a disproportionate white population. And so there's an argument that that's sort of what's going on, too.
But there's no racist intent to it. I mean, different people's oxes get gored differently in different eras and different years. So even though the Electoral College arrangement was conceived in racist sin, it's not per se a racist institution. It's kind of a regionalist institution, you know. It elevates geography above every other aspect of human existence and makes that the determination to whether your vote really counts.
So I recently had a chance to talk to a fourth grade classroom about the Electoral College, and they were learning about politics and how elections are run, and I asked them if it was fair.
Is the Electoral College fair?
No, because it's not really them who's voting for president, it's someone else who's voting for a president.
Does it seem fair to you?
Not really.
Why not?
It should have been for all the people, not just the electors, to cast a vote. You should be able to have a say in voting. It is not a very good system, I don't think, because it makes it so that lots of people aren't allowed to vote. And I don't really think that's fair. People deserve to be able to decide what their country is doing.
And then we took a vote. About 80%, maybe even 90% of the kids said that the Electoral College was unfair. So if even a bunch of 9 and 10-year-olds know that the Electoral College is unfair and can articulate pretty well why it's unfair, why do we still have it?
Because it takes 2/3 of both houses of Congress and 3/4 of the state legislatures to amend the Constitution. That's one reason. The other reason, and the biggest reason, is the winner-take-all system, which took 20, 30, 40 years to be adopted by all the states. Different states had different ways of appointing their electors. Some it was election by district. Some it was election by slate. There were a lot of different ways to do it. And only, I think, two states did it winner take all in the beginning. But then as after the 1800 election, when Jefferson lost to Adams, because some of the northern states had adopted winner-take-all, whereas Virginia was still doing it where they split the electors roughly proportionately. Jefferson said, even though this is a horrible thing, this winner-take-all, we have to do it because it's political suicide not to if the other guys are doing it. So gradually, it was an arms race. Everybody ended up doing winner-take-all, and now it's in 48 of the 50 states.
Right. So one's going to blink first, basically, in terms of
any state right. that any state that went to a different system, like proportional division or division by congressional district, would lose influence.
So you mentioned a constitutional amendment. There have been like umpteen tries to alter since the 12th Amendment. So that was in the wake of the 1800 election, like you mentioned. That was the last time we actually changed the Electoral College. But the last big effort at a constitutional amendment was in the late 1960s, and it foundered in the Senate.
I think it was killed by a filibuster, actually, in the Senate. It had passed the House. It was ready to go. It had won the requisite two-thirds in the House. It had two-thirds in the Senate, too, but it was killed in a filibuster. And the thing about what made 1960 such a possibility for doing it was that Nixon had won the election by a very narrow popular majority and a big electoral majority. So he was for it, and he could be for it because it didn't call into his legitimacy into question. You know, when after the 2000 election, we did not have any effort to do anything about the Electoral College. And I think that was largely because to support it, the Republicans or George W. Bush would have had to say, well, my election wasn't really legit. And you can't expect that.
Yeah. And Nixon was an interesting case because he won in 1968 with a majority of the votes and the Electoral College. But he in 1960, had narrowly lost.
Very narrowly. Maybe he hadn't even lost in the popular vote. It depends on how you count Alabama's voters.
Yeah. So he sort of knew what it was like to have the Electoral College bite you.
Mm-hmm.
So probably a constitutional amendment to the Electoral College is off the table at this stage of the game. As you point out, in 2000, George Bush wasn't going to undermine his legitimacy. Donald Trump not likely to do either, even though he has previously said he actually would support a popular vote for the president. So that leaves an alternative.
I don't think you should mess with the Constitution unless you have to. And we do not have to mess with the Constitution. We don't have to change a word of the Constitution in order to achieve the goal of a popular election of the president. Remember what the Constitution says. It gives the state legislatures the power to, quote, appoint their electors any way they choose. Okay, so let's imagine that a state legislature decides to appoint the electors of the candidate, not necessarily who wins their state, but who wins in the whole United States of America. Now, one state doing that would have to be sent into a mental hospital for sheer stupidity. But suppose enough states said it that they would do it all at once to make 270 electoral votes. Suppose they signed a kind of treaty, an interstate compact, saying once states with 270 electoral votes have said, yes, we're going to give our votes to the winner of the national popular vote, then all of a sudden, once that kicked in, every vote in the entire country would be equal. Every vote would be worth going after. There would no longer be an incentive for administrations to shower favors on battleground states and ignore big states. It would have a very healthy effect on national policy in that sense. It would mean that throughout the whole country, you could have grassroots politics. It would diminish the power of money relative to the power of organization and mobilization and personal contact. And you could do it, and you should do it, without touching the U.S. Constitution. The calls for a constitutional amendment, I understand the impulse, I share the impulse behind them, but they're wrongheaded because there is this better way of doing it, the so-called National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. And weirdly, most people, even most very well-informed people, haven't even heard of this. And that includes people who live in the 11 states or the 10 states plus the District of Columbia, whose legislatures have passed and whose governors have signed these identical bills that would create this interstate compact. States with 165 electoral votes have already agreed to this over the past 10 years.
So by my math, that means we need another 105 electoral college votes to be committed to this scheme.
That's right.
To get us to the 270. So we used to have a game in my office where we were working on some of these issues, and the game was explain the National Popular Vote Compact in one sentence.
Oh, did anyone win?
No one ever won. But the general...
This is one of the problems with it. It had to be explained to me three times before I got it. And when I got it, like a light bulb went off above my head. This was 10 years ago, and I have been obsessed, is a fair word. I've been obsessed with it ever since, because however complicated it may seem at first glance, however hard it is for even relatively intelligent people like myself to kind of grasp how the mechanism works, it's an absolutely brilliant solution.
New York State is one of the states that has actually kind of entered the compact. It's got 29 electoral college votes. And New York State has essentially committed to giving those 29 votes to the popular vote winner in the presidency. But it won't give those 29 votes until cumulatively 270 votes are committed to this scheme.
That's right. We don't like to think of it as a scheme. But yes, you've got it right.
So you talked a little bit about this. What would happen if we instituted the national popular vote? You believe it would reduce the influence of money in politics. It would
lead to wiser policy decisions.
It would eliminate the situation where the person who wins the popular vote loses the electoral college.
It would do that. That's not a small advantage. It's not the biggest advantage, but it's not a small one. And of course, we don't know. Since we've never had a national election, we can't say what a national election would be like or who might have won in 2000 or who might have won this year. It's a different dynamic.
Mitch McConnell, the current majority leader of the Senate, once called it the stupidest, most dangerous idea that he'd heard of.
Which, the national popular vote?
Yeah, exactly. I'm not entirely sure what his argument was against it, but I do know that some people make two arguments against it. One is that it would actually increase sectionalism, that you would have candidates, for example, who would campaign on the West and the East Coast, and that they would basically ignore the Midwest, and you would have other candidates who would just campaign in the Midwest, or that you might go back to elections that were sort of like we had in the 1820s, where you had six or seven candidates who had regional power.
That's a very puzzling objection, because the exact opposite is the truth. The Electoral College, as it's currently constituted, does in fact encourage regional candidates, because a regional candidate can win electors in a small number of states where its voters are concentrated. That's why George Wallace, with 3 or 4% of the vote, could rack up 15 or 20 electoral votes, where Ross Perot, who got 15% of the vote nationally, got zero. So it suggests the reverse when it comes to regionalism. And as for the idea, and we hear this a lot, that candidates would only campaign in the big cities and they'd ignore the rest of the country. You have to look at the pattern in the battleground states. In the battleground states, that's not what candidates do. They divide their time into all different parts of the state. No presidential candidate would be stupid enough to just insult a huge swath of the country. And there's absolutely no reason to believe that there would be a multiplicity of candidates any more than there is in any other single seat or single office election. We don't see this in a state like Texas or California or New York. We don't see this in states that are as big as most countries. And so all the reasons why you don't have multi-party systems in individual states would apply to the whole country just as much.
Another argument that I've heard is that, oh, God, what would happen if we actually had to do a national recount? Mm. You know, we've got just a ramshackle system. You know, the voting systems are all over the map in terms of their effectiveness. And can you imagine if it were really close and we actually had to do a nationwide recount?
Well, a nationwide recount would be rare to the point of absurdity. It's been calculated that the occasion for that kind of a recount would come up roughly once every 740 years. If an election were close enough to require recounts, you'd actually get recounts governed by the laws of the particular states. But this is one of those problems that's more severe, far more severe under the status quo, because every election is the equivalent of 50 elections. And in every election, a small number of votes, as we saw in 2000, but we see it virtually in every election, a small number of votes in a particular state or two or three particular states changes 100% of the electors of those states. So you have a situation in which a matter of hundreds or thousands of votes can make the 100% difference. But even if it happened, our ramshackle system could handle it.
Yeah.
Our ramshackle system would be a little less ramshackle if we had national popular vote. But it's not as if it ain't ramshackle now. It's way, way worse ramshackle now.
So a little bit more than halfway there on the national popular vote compact being able to go into effect. What is it going to take to make that happen? Who's signed it so far? What's stopping?
Well, the 11 states that have done it are all different sizes, some small, some medium, some large. What they all have in common, problematically, is they're all blue states. So the success of this is going to depend on red states, on some red states coming along. Now, there are plenty of Republicans who favor this reform. It's passed in a number of single houses of red states, including like the Oklahoma Senate, not exactly a bastion of East Coast liberalism. The New York State Senate, which is Republican-controlled, overwhelmingly passed it. And there are prominent Republicans who have examined this idea and decided they really like it. I mean, Newt Gingrich being one. However, now that the Republicans have arguably benefited twice in the last five elections, I guess, from the distortions of the way the Electoral College is now chosen, we have to face the fact that this makes it a lot harder to persuade Republican politicians to go along with this. It is in their interest as politicians. See, it's in the interest of politicians in non-battleground states to do this because they, not just the voters are ignored in those states, the politicians are ignored too. They don't get their phone calls returned from national headquarters. But this election, which has shown, which has sort of highlighted the need for a national popular vote, has made the challenge of getting to a national popular vote interstate compact harder. We have to face up to that. There's no reason why Republicans should be more unfriendly to this than Democrats, except for the fact that the Democrats' ox is the one that got gored, so to speak.
Pun intended, right? Yeah.
Unintended, actually. Yeah. it just came.
So the Electoral College, it's served us well and not so well for 240 years and doesn't sound like you're too optimistic about.
I am optimistic. And I think it's conceivable. It's still conceivable that enough Republicans will come around. Trump himself has made the crucial point when he said, hey, if it had been a national election, I would have run my campaign differently and I still would have won and won big. And I don't normally go around praising the perspicacity of Donald Trump, but that shows some understanding of what the real dynamics are here. So I think it's possible. It might not be possible for the next 3 or 4 years might have to be devoted really to an educational effort more than anything else. Eventually, the worm is going to turn. And the states that have adopted this bill, there's no time limit to it. It sits there until it's repealed. I think that it conceivably could happen by 2020 and is kind of likely to happen by 2024. And if we are ever going to do something about the Electoral College system and make it correspond to what a modern democracy, a modern representative republic, if you like, needs and deserves, this is the way we're going to have to do it. And again, it's a better way than amending the Constitution.
Let's come back to 2016. As you pointed out, no telling how this election would have turned out if it actually had been a popular vote election rather than an Electoral College-driven election. But still, there are a lot of people out there who've got these kind of Hail Mary plans for fixing the wrong outcome that happened this year. Faithless electors. I'm not sure I'd want to run into one of them in a dark alley, but there are like a lot of people out there calling for some faithless electors.
I think that's partly based on a misconception that a lot of people have. They think that each state has a set of electors that then are instructed to vote a certain way. So that somehow there are a lot of electors in states that Trump carried who are actually Democrats, and they're just being ordered to vote this way. So that if they follow their conscience, they'd vote a different way. It doesn't work that way. It's the electors are chosen by the candidates. They're not likely to abandon the candidate that chose them. This is a fantasy. The idea that somehow faithless electors are going to change the outcome of this election, it's part of the grief process. It's the denial stage.
So done. Got to live with the consequences, right?
Can anyone suggest an alternative to living with the consequences? These were the rules of the game. And you can't change them because you don't like the outcome. Well, you can change them. You just can't change them retrospectively. You can change them for the future, but you can't change them for the past.
That was Hendrik Hertzberg, staff writer at The New Yorker and editorial director at The Nation Institute. We've been trying in America to change the way we elect presidents pretty much since we started electing them. And more constitutional amendments have been introduced in Congress to change it than for any other constitutional subject. All of them have been fruitless. So it remains to be seen if this time will be different. Thanks for joining us for this edition of The Line. For more about voting rights, visit us at brennancenter.org. And subscribe to our podcasts, including The Line, for much more on the critical issues of voting and democracy in America. A quick shout out to David Shulman, who produced this episode and all of the episodes of The Line. For the Brennan Center for Justice, I'm Victoria Bassetti.